at the UN Security Council.
The United States right now cannot force any United Nations member state to step down from any resolution that was submitted in 2015 by the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, or they cannot force them to impose any new sanctions or restrictions in the sanctions against Iran for any Israeli-American needs. Russia and China will be outside the vote. Regarding the JCPOA, the United States needs to have 5 votes, but without getting the 2 votes, it seems the decision on the JCPOA will be taken by 4: the United States, the United Kingdom, France, and Germany. That will not take place to be just another resolution at the United Nations. That is why they cannot force them for a resolution. If they want to go ahead, they can only go ahead with the companies which are related to the United States, or any companies they can threaten or promote. For the countries and the companies which they can threaten, they can go ahead under the table with an unofficial or unethical way. For the countries and companies which they cannot threaten, they need to have promotions which must be related to the level of investment in those countries or companies to have the sanctions in effect. But for a United Nations Security Council resolution, they can do nothing.
Only the Israeli regime and the Persian Gulf states agreed with the US's snapback claim. What does it indicate?
The United States and the Israeli regime go ahead with the cooperation rated with their culture blocking, which is in the West Asia region, especially in the west coast of the Persian Gulf. Those states do not have a history nor a culture. They do not have unity. By unity, I mean to have a decision internally, as it must be a union of Arabs or Islamic countries to have their owner and fight for their owner. So they lose those tools and the United States can control them. By promoting some of the emirs and the kings over there, it makes them the leaders of the countries and feeds them a high amount of responsibilities and authority that they can show that they are the leaders of the area. For instance, that is why once they started the war in Yemen, Abu Dhabi and Riyadh went ahead with that without thinking on the relations and reactions that what would be the like if they step back in case they fail in that war, and that is what has happened. That means that they do not have a culture of thinking. They cannot estimate what the next step will be and in which direction.
European News Bulletin.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Here is our top story. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has reiterated he is confident the UK will prosper outside the EU if the post-Brexit deal is not agreed with the bloc. The two sides met today in a bid to reach an agreement as the deadline for negotiations expires in the coming days. The UK's chief negotiator, David Frost, says there has been progress in a positive direction, but warned significant sections are yet to be agreed. Sticking points include competition rules and state aid for businesses, as well as fishing rights. The UK left the EU at the end of January, but continues to follow the bloc's rules until the end of the year. Any deal between the UK and EU would need to be ratified by Parliament before December 31st. If no agreement is reached, trade between the two will default to World Trade Organization rules, with tariffs said to be introduced on many imports and exports, which will push up prices for both sides. Well, let's discuss that with Jonathan Fryer. He is an author and political commentator joining me now. Good to have you with us, as always. So Dominic Cummings, Downing Street's biggest Brexit advocate, is out of the picture. Does this hint at the government's future strategy?
I think there will be a change of tone in the way the government handles the last few days of the Brexit negotiations. Dominic Cummings, the arch-Brexiteer and architect of the Leave campaign 4 years ago in the referendum, where it was very much in favour of a belligerent tone, which rather alarmed the EU, which is used to more diplomatic language. So I think we will see a change of tone, but whether that will be enough to actually get us over the line in the next few days is quite another matter.
That is quite another matter indeed, because it looks like an impasse to me. There is still the issue of the internal markets bill. They say, the Brits say, we're going to go ahead with it. The European Union, together with the Irish, they're saying, you know what, this is going to create serious problems.
Yes, the internal market bill, if it does get ratified by the House of Commons, having of course been rejected by the House of Lords, or at least amended by the House of Lords, would be a huge problem if it goes ahead, because it quite clearly jeopardizes the Good Friday Agreement about Northern Ireland, which is why Ireland is so upset about it. And the EU27 will, in solidarity with Ireland, make sure that if that it goes ahead in the way that it is at the moment, then no deal will happen.
Some also believe that the government here wants to a no deal, which can lead to significant deregulation. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's certainly true that some members of the cabinet would prefer a no deal, and they see a sort of future for Britain as a sort of Singapore off the coast of Europe, trading with totally different sorts of standards on environment and labour laws and all sorts of things, which would, of course, from the EU's point of view, be unfair competition. But I don't think that's the view of all of the members of the government, or indeed of the Conservative Party. And there are still many who would actually prefer there to be a deal at the last minute.
And you touched upon the Good Friday Agreement. How has the U.S. election impacted the U.K.'s negotiating stance, considering what we heard President-elect Joe Biden say about the deal earlier on?
Well, the change of government in Washington next January is going to have a huge impact on the transatlantic relationship, in particular with relating to the EU, because whereas Trump was an ardent supporter of Brexit and was all in favour of Britain going it alone, Biden, on the other hand, as the descendant of Irish Catholics, very much is in favour of the Good Friday Agreement, and has made it very clear that if the internal market bill is not amended in the way we just discussed, then it will mean that there will be no US-British deal soon, or indeed ever.
And very briefly, just to reiterate, do you think there will be a deal, considering they have 40-something days to go?
I think it's possible, but it's not very likely, quite frankly. Unless they stop the clock, which occasionally happens in these negotiations, I think both sides will be feeling increasingly pessimistic.
All right, Jonathan Fryer with your thoughts. Thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. Moving on now, but staying in this country, Britain has suffered the biggest GDP drop among major economies, listed by the country's Office for National Statistics. Its gross domestic product remains almost 10% smaller than at the end of 2019, twice as big as the falls in Italy, Germany, and France. And despite a lackluster recovery, the second lockdown and uncertainty surrounding the post-Brexit trade deal, as we just discussed, means the British economy will be hobbling well into next year. Here is more.
With Christmas right around the corner, retailers can only hope and pray the November lockdown is not extended beyond December 2nd. After the severe blow dealt it by the first lockdown, the British economy bounced back by 15.5% in the July to September period. But the worry is that it will shrink again over the winter months. Weak household spending is being blamed for the UK's poor GDP performances.
The unemployment rate in the UK is continuing to surge, and redundancy rates are at an all-time high. Millions of Britons are struggling to make ends meet, and millions more are saving their pennies for even rainier days.
I'm quite happy with what the Chancellor has done. Of course, everybody is. And everybody won't be when they talk about how to get those monies back. I mean, he's talked about cutting duty-free. People are complaining about that.
Concerned, very concerned about the younger people in particular, because of unemployment, because of the huge debt there's going to be. It's a massive, massive worry. And I don't think we've seen how bad it's going to be yet.
I think the situation with Brexit is a complete shambles. You know, it seems the government doesn't seem to have a grip on it, just as it doesn't seem to have a grip on the COVID epidemic. I mean, it's terribly worrying. I mean, I've got two sons, both who work in hospitality, and they're worried stiff about what's going to happen.
The extension of the furlough scheme might help encourage spending. The government will now be paying 80% of the salaries of workers retained by firms rather than fired until March. Britain's manufacturing sector will be getting a massive tax break extension as well. But according to the Bank of England, things will get worse before they get better. It predicts the UK's GDP could shrink by 2% in the October-December quarter, and its economy is likely to shrink by a record 11% in 2020, before growing by just 7% in 2021. But did the UK have this coming despite COVID-19?
The present situation started a year ago, last September, when the banks began to refuse to lend money to each other, and there was a panic in the banking system. Now, that is always the first sign of a coming huge economic collapse. It always happens about a year or two before the actual collapse. The debt levels have built up to be completely unrepayable. The rich-poor division has increased, and the type of jobs coming into existence due to the technological shift are now temporary and part-time.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Director of Communications, Lee Kane, has quit, and now his top advisor, Dominic Cummings, has left as well. Some say this will make for smoother Brexit talks, due to resume this week before an EU summit on Thursday. Bianca Rahimi, London.
All the way to the South Caucasus now, where ethnic Armenian villagers in Nagorno-Karabakh have set fire to their houses before fleeing to Armenia on the eve of a deadline that'll see parts of the territory handed over to Azerbaijan as part of a ceasefire agreement.
They say that everybody must leave by the evening. The Azeris will be here tomorrow morning. They will be here. They will live here. Damn them. Let them live here.
Russian peacekeeping troops stood outside a 12th century Armenian Christian monastery to protect it. The imminent renewal of Azerbaijani control has raised widespread concerns about the fate of cultural and religious sites in the region. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called for a two-state solution in Cyprus. The president made the comments during a visit to Varosha, a beach town in northern Cyprus. The area has been fenced off and abandoned since Turkey's invasion of northern Cyprus in 1974. Only Ankara recognizes northern Cyprus as an independent state, and it has no diplomatic relations with the government of Cyprus, which is a member of the European Union. On the ongoing dispute with Greece and the EU over hydrocarbon resources in the eastern Mediterranean, Erdogan also declared that Turkey and northern Cyprus would no longer tolerate diplomatic games in the fight over territorial rights. Back in this country, a new scandal has hit the British Labour Party, this time involving rampant Islamophobia within its ranks. A new report has made several shocking discoveries, which appear to show that hatred of Muslims is at an all-time high, but the response to the findings has been lukewarm. Robert Carter brings us all the details.
The British Labour Party has found itself entangled in yet another racism crisis after a new report found huge levels of Islamophobia within the party. The report, commissioned by the newly formed Labour Muslim Network, suggests that current party leader Sir Keir Starmer has greatly lost the trust of his party's Muslim members. Just some of the damning results claim that
more than one in four Muslim members and supporters have experienced Islamophobia within party ranks. 59% say they do not feel well represented by the leadership. 55% claim they don't even trust the leadership to tackle Islamophobia effectively. while 46% feel the party doesn't represent the community effectively.
In response to the report, I reached out to British Muslims who have already decided to quit the party to ask why they felt they had to leave.
And from the people I've met, the counsellors I've experienced, the talking I've had conversations, prior to even Keir Starmer's appointment, there was a problem within the Labour Party. Once he came into his position, it just reinforced everything that we were already saying that is happening and existing. And this was the reason for my exodus and a large exodus by my community.
The report, which interviewed hundreds of British Muslim members, added that some key policy issues create hurt amongst Muslims, including its stance on Israeli crimes in Palestine and Starmer's U-turn on Labour's Kashmir policy earlier this year.
Leave the Labour Party, cut off your cards, and let your friends and family know that this is what's happening, and Keir Starmer shouldn't be able to silently still get our vote and then still implement these ways. Labour is a failed system. Labour is a crumbling system, and Labour is not something that will represent us as British Muslims who live in the UK now. You know, it's just not. And Keir Starmer, I would sincerely hope that you would consider your position on the Kashmir issue.
Before Starmer took over, the party was rocked by the anti-Semitism crisis for many years. Some even argue it's what brought down the previous leadership. But the question is, will the response be the same to this blatant crisis of Islamophobia within the party? Many are arguing not. Robert Carter, London.
An update now on the story we covered before. Human rights campaigners have gathered on the Canary Islands to demand better living conditions for thousands of migrants who have reached the Spanish islands from West Africa. A slow procession crossed the island of Gran Canaria before reaching the docks in the town of Mogán, where nearly 2,000 migrants are living in conditions described as degrading and inhumane. The Coast Guard rescued another 700 people on Saturday. 17,000 migrants have arrived on the islands this year alone, 10 times the numbers last year. Deepening economic hardship due to the coronavirus pandemic is pushing more people to seek better lives elsewhere. Many of them die along the way. Spain's regional policy minister says they're planning to expand naval patrols around the Canary Islands and set up more migrant centers in response to the surge in arrivals. Another breakthrough now in the fight against coronavirus as U.S.-based company Moderna has revealed its vaccine is 94.5% effective. The results come hot on the heels of similar results from German company BioNTech, which revealed its drug was 90% effective in preventing COVID. The Moderna vaccine, trialed on more than 30,000 U.S. volunteers, is not expected to be available outside the U.S. until next year. So far, Japan, Canada, Switzerland, Qatar, all signed agreements to procure the drug for 2021. The news bodes well for other COVID-19 vaccines, with a third one from the joint venture between Oxford University and UK pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca due to report findings in the coming days and weeks. In this segment, the quote-unquote Million MAGA March in Washington, D.C. on the weekend, a gathering described by one researcher as the debut of the pro-Trump insurgency, a preview of the multi-headed Hydra, a far-right opposition expected when Biden takes office. All of those people believe that the election was rigged, just like the president in the White House at the moment. Joining me now to discuss that story, Richard Sudan. Richard, tell us what's been happening.
So we had thousands, not a million, of Trump supporters convening in Washington, D.C., protesting the election result. And one of those groups was the Proud Boys. Before we get into this discussion, I want a clip of an initiation ceremony of the so-called Proud Boys.
A proud chauvinist is what they said there, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, you could probably argue they resemble kind of drunk frat boys or college boys more than any proud boys. But what I thought was interesting in that clip is that they talk about them creating the modern world, when I think the reality for many people who understand history is that for thousands of years there were complex, highly sophisticated cultures in places like Africa, which actually were in existence long before the kind of modern democracies and civilizations of Greece and Rome, for example, were even conceptualized, were even talked about as ideas. And I think a lot of people actually would say that kind of European exceptionalism, quote unquote, if you like, far from creating the modern world, has actually destroyed the modern world with kind of European colonialism plundering continents and countries, taking resources and human beings as captives to actually build up their so-called civilizations. And I think this is the reality for a lot of people. Of course, in many ways, this is a laughable clip, but actually this, you know, really gets to the heart of kind of racial superiority complex and kind of pseudoscience regarding this false narrative, this false history that's kind of put forward. Mm-hmm. Just want to go to one reaction first, if I can, from Tariq Nasheed, who says, "The Proud Boys is a deputized white supremacist terror group promoted by right-wing media, and they're even protected by the white liberal media as well, because many of the founders and members and other alt-right affiliates worked in liberal media at one point." And another reaction on this point is from Denmark Vesey, who says, "We have to remember the founder of the Proud Boys, white supremacist Gavin McInnes, also founded Vice News, and they refuse to call them out as white supremacists, even though they're supposed to be a liberal network." So, you know, the clip was funny in many ways, but actually there's a more sinister side, of course, to the Proud Boys. They are a white supremacist terror group. This is how people view them, and they are intent on malicious, destructive behavior, and they want to attack black people and other non-white people.
You spoke of the sinister side of it all, and what some people are saying is these people are the public face of those who are making plots and machinations in the background, people whose names we don't know.
Exactly, of course. Now, if we talk about racism as a structure of power, of course, the structure isn't new. And of course, a lot of people would say these groups are kind of symptoms of a much wider, much deeper, much more long-standing problem. Much like Trump, of course, we know the comments and the actions he's taken. But again, he's a symptom of a much deeper condition. And of course, this rally was really about Trump's base being mobilized, etc. But it really speaks to a much more sinister problem in the United States, which really I don't think is going to go anywhere anytime soon.
And Richard, they called it the million MAGA march, but there were barely a few, more than a few thousand people, apparently. Or do you have any other accounts of what went down
on
Saturday?
The reports I saw, no one quoted a million. There were certainly thousands, but I think also a lot of people think the Million Man Mass March, the name of it, was actually ripped off from Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam, which, of course, I think that march took place in the 90s. So I don't think anybody takes these groups seriously. They take themselves very seriously. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you know, we should be under no doubt about the intent they want to have and the havoc they want to wreak on the streets. You know, they're attacking people left, right and centre. Not just them, there are various other groups, different militia that are popping up. But things are very serious in the US right now.
All right. Let's bring us back here in the UK. We saw two people leave Downing Street over the past week. Lee Kane, followed by Dominic Cummings. I think that's the focus of your story.
Exactly. I want to talk about Dominic Cummings, who, of course, has resigned. But, of course, this really gets to the heart of kind of chaos, confusion, and catastrophe, really, at the heart of government. Now, of course, Dominic Cummings was one of the chief architects of the Leave campaign, and I think anyone that studies Cummings knows that this was a long-standing ambition that he wanted to exact when he got to government. But, of course, now we've had a sort of tide of political change in the United States, and I think one of the reasons Cummings was pushed out is really, of course, they're talking about briefings against Boris Johnson's, Carrie Simmons, the Prime Minister's partner. But of course, a lot of people think Johnson might want to strike a different tone with Biden now in power. Does Johnson want to appear more centrist? Is he thinking about the Brexit negotiations? Does he want to strike a different tone? Possibly.
Launch a reset of his government, they say. But you know, you hear words like power struggle. He walked out over a power. What exactly was the beef? Well, why did this whole thing happen?
Well, apparently the official reason is Dominic Cummings was briefing civil servants against what Boris Johnson wanted him to. But again, I think a lot of people quite simply see this as a purge from Downing Street. And again, a lot of people would really characterise Boris Johnson as not really having one particular ideology. He very much flows with whatever the tide of populism is. Of course, he's famed for writing two articles for The Telegraph several years ago, one for Vote Leave, one for Remain. And so he doesn't really have a staunch ideology, so to speak. Boris Johnson's ideology is he wants power.
But the line that the Conservative MPs and others, some of them, have been saying is that advisors have a shelf life, and his shelf life had come to an end, and so he had to go.
Of course, but many of these MPs, many of these advisors actually have a kind of secret loathing for Boris Johnson, but of course he was able to push them a year ago. He was able to win an election and get a resounding majority, which no one thought he was going to get. So they're thinking, some might argue, as much about their political skin and their own careers as anything else. Let's go to a tweet from Naomi McCarthy, who says, "My own theory is that Cummings set up the photo op to draw a line publicly under his time at number 10. Whatever happens now isn't anything to do with the Super Forecaster, who might just have super forecasted that Brexit is going to be catastrophically bad." And we have a tweet from Adam, who says, "Everyone is affected. Mo Cummings and the Vote Leave cabal have been swept out of Downing Street by the Biden tsunami wave. Some dark money and outfits like Cambridge Analytica that won it for Trump, won it for Leave. Trump and Brexit are one in the same."
All right, we're going to have to leave it there for now. Richard Sedan, thank you for those two stories. And thank you, everyone. See you again soon.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, if you remember, it was said that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, considered acquisition of knowledge as a great divine obligation. The Imam strive to learn knowledge and also encourage others to acquire it. Imam Khomeini's method of education, both in learning and teaching, was very outstanding amongst ulama and religious scholars and students of seminaries. Imam Khomeini used to criticize the sayings and ideas of others, whilst he himself would accept the criticism of others. Stay tuned for more. Ancient philosophers like Plato and Aristotle believed that those who acquire knowledge should have the spirit of accepting criticism. Criticism does not mean finding fault with others. It means to be able to think independently, and it turns the individual from a passive recipient into an active learner. Some of the adherents of this thought maintain that critical thought is a conscious phase of processing information in a way that the individual is able to understand subjects better and make better decisions with higher self-reliance. Raising fundamental questions on a particular issue, asking about the existing results and hypotheses, abandoning bias and fanaticism, studying new sources, and consorting with creative people are among the methods of attaining the skill of criticism. The individual should be able to get rid of the chains of confirmation of others. Human beings usually like to be approved by others. That's why they think that if they show innovation, they will lose the approval of others. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, was one of the rare ulama or religious scholars who used to encourage students of seminaries to criticize the ideas of others, even his own ideas. He would even encourage them to criticize the ideas of great scholars and ulama of the past and present which had been accepted and approved as dogma. Hujjat al-Islam Muhammad Reza Nasiri says in this regard, Imam Khomeini used to examine the statements of Ayatollah Sheikh Muhammad Hussein Qaravi a lot because his statements were mixed with philosophy and jurisprudential issues. Then the Imam would explicate those issues completely and raise his own theory. He used to say, the greatness of great people shouldn't prevent us from understanding. No matter how great the words are, you should employ your understanding. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, used to challenge the ideas of great religious scholars or ulama, although he would respect them very much. Late Ayatollah Abul Qasim Khazali says, Imam Khomeini, in his class, used to grapple with the great scholars who had caused knowledge to reach climax, and he would succeed. His pupils and friends and our colleagues too would benefit from and be strengthened with his courses. Along his scientific struggle with great scholars, he would say to his pupils, when you're hearing my words, do not accept them submissively. Think about them and argue. Keep your thought free for argument and do not say that the teacher has said so and so or such and such. Okay, the teacher has said, but you should employ your own thoughts. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, would tell the students, who were silent with no disputes, here is not the place of preaching and eulogy to keep silent. Late Hujjat al-Islam Mustafa Zamani says, as a custom, when a preacher ascends the pulpit, people keep silent and listen attentively. But the course of ijtihad is not like that. The student should be free to question the teacher. Several times the students of Imam Khomeini didn't ask anything from him in the middle of the class. Their mom would tell them, "This is not the session of eulogy. Why don't you protest or object me or ask questions?" This characteristic of Imam Khomeini had made his classes very effective, very popular, and very fruitful. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Mahdi Yasribi narrates an anecdote relating to one of the classes of Imam Khomeini when there were heated disputes. He says, "I remember well that people like Mata Mutahari, Mata Beheshti and others would participate in his classes in the first years. When we passed by, there were heated disputes with loud voices and the students had the same spirit of objection, and the Imam would answer as a great teacher." One of the things that Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, innovated was to break the taboo of criticizing great figures. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Amid Zamani said, "One of the things that the Imam raised in Najaf as a novel issue was criticism in jurisprudence. Personalities were usually esteemed, highly esteemed in Najaf. I mean, the personality was first, and then it would be the turn for arguments. Many students would be amazed that the Imam listened to them carefully and attentively and answered their questions." This was whilst in some of the courses that we attended, nobody had the right to ask a question with the pretext that the time of class is for all. Thus, free thinking was choked. Dear listeners, although Imam Khomeini would welcome critical thinking, he never allowed the time of the class to be wasted on useless and lengthy arguments. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Dangerudi says, in this regard, "Imam Khomeini believed that a student should argue within the class. Yet, if a question and answer was repeated several times, he would prevent it, saying that it is not a dialogue."
Around the World with Reporters.
Once again, the violent clashes. The police tear gassed protesters to disperse them in Pakistan's garrison city of Rawalpindi near capital Islamabad. Nonetheless, a massive crowd emerged on the streets despite chilly weather conditions. At the heart of an intense public anger is the display of a blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet of Islam by the French government on state-run buildings last month. Since then, there has been no let-up to the protest like this in Pakistan. The frequent publications, newspapers, and public display of anti-Islamic blasphemous cartoons have ignited an unprecedented scale of public resentment against France and its citizens in Pakistan. Protesters vowed to avenge the blasphemers of the Prophet of the Islam.
"The honor of our Prophet is being insulted by the President of France. We demand the government official to kick out the ambassador of France right now from the Pakistan. Otherwise, these all people will protest. We will march in millions towards the embassy of France. We will march in millions, inshallah."
Being here in this weather, in this condition, against the government of France, against the officials, who they are not kicking the France ambassador from the Pakistan, why we are here? To protect our respect of our holy prophet Muhammad Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. No one can stop us to protect the our own religion, over the respect of our holy prophet Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam.
Pakistan's mainstream media largely opted to black out the coverage of this protest, allegedly under pressure to contain the agitation on this most sensitive issue. The organizers complain that their large number of protesters were arrested to prevent them to participate in the gathering. The government suspended all cell phone services and blocked all major highways to prevent the entry of angry protesters in the capital city. The extraordinary security measures have been undertaken to avert the repetition of violent clashes happened not far from French embassy in Islamabad in early this month. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
It seems the growing number of coronavirus infections and deaths has not yet sounded the alarm in Turkey's government offices to impose another lockdown in the country. The reluctance comes amid reports that the flow of tourists is still going strong in Turkey amid the pandemic, especially in its largest city of Istanbul, which has not only the highest number of tourists, but also the highest number of coronavirus infections and deaths. The city counts for about 40% of confirmed infected cases in Turkey. This number forced the mayor of Istanbul, Ekrem İmamoğlu, to call on the government to impose a total lockdown in the city for at least 2 to 3 weeks. However, his call was rejected.
When we look at the current data, it is obvious that a lockdown is absolutely necessary. I have shared this issue with all the authorities and people of Istanbul. I think a 2 to 3 week lockdown is necessary. This is highly advised by our scientists and experts.
Many believe that the government's decision is deeply rooted in its economic concerns. The government officials maintain that the closure of restaurants and public places at 10 p.m., along with social distancing and wearing masks, is enough to contain the virus.
The second wave of the coronavirus is spreading all over the world, and the situation is getting worse. Many governments may consider lockdown as an effective way to cope with the pandemic, but lockdown has its own consequences. Many people will lose their jobs, and it seems the Turkish government is now mainly concerned with the economic aspects of the lockdown.
Turkey's Cultural and Tourism Ministry announced last week that since the end of the last lockdown several months ago, the country has had 9.46 million visitors from various countries, including European ones, where the pandemic has hit the most. Those arriving to Turkey are not even being tested, which makes the spread of the virus even easier. Many here say Turkish government is favoring economy over public health. Now, the main question is how far the government may remain reluctant to meet the growing demands for lockdown as the country's coronavirus infections and death are getting out of control. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has strongly rejected a round of one-year-long sanctions fired by the European Union, which challenges the legitimacy of the upcoming legislative elections in the Latin American nation. Nicolas Maduro made the remarks after the EU's European Council condemned a decision by the Supreme Court of Venezuela to reshuffle the composition of the country's National Electoral Council. Maduro said the move by the European body is influenced by the regime change policy of the United States, which refuses to recognize Maduro's presidency and the country's legal institutions. The Venezuelan head of state said the elections will take place despite the economic sanctions because they follow the rule of the national constitution. Officials totally back Maduro's statement.
The EU sanctions are a violation of international law, and therefore we absolutely repudiate them. From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy.
From a different perspective, many opposition members justify the EU policy. However, experts say the EU sanctions are unfounded and influenced by Washington.
The EU is mistaken in politically following the US meddlesome policy. The truth is, most political parties are running in these legislative elections.
Despite the aggression by the EU, the government of Venezuela says Maduro will go on as the country's president and parliamentary elections will be held this year because Venezuela is a free country and it won't be brought to its knees by foreign sanctions. Jesus Silva Caracas.
In a somber silence, France marked 5 years since the November 15 attacks. 130 people were killed in what is the country's deadliest peacetime attack. Takfiri extremists linked to Daesh claimed responsibility for the attack as a response to France's military involvement in Syria and Iraq. Prime Minister Jean Castex led the commemorations as France finds itself in the midst of more Takfiri extremism and growing Islamophobia, polarizing the population. In the past few weeks, Takfiri extremists have killed 4 people after a series of Islamophobic statements from President Emmanuel Macron, as well as the overt promotion of blasphemous cartoons of Prophet Muhammad. Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan also condemned Macron's rhetoric.
Mekke, Medine, Asya'ya.
It is an issue of honor for us to stand against the attacks against our Prophet who honored the entire world. The West are once again heading for a period of barbarity. France and Europe in general, they don't deserve the policies of Macron and those with similar mindsets that spread seeds of hate.
French Muslim leaders have condemned all forms of violence and have called for restraint. France is also calling for a crackdown of foreign funding that it says stokes extremist sentiments. But wide-ranging condemnation of the entire Muslim community by politicians has only deepened divisions. Yesterday, France hosted the Paris Peace Forum, where leaders discussed the ongoing threat of extremism.
No one can say when the pandemic will stop, nor when terrorism will be vanquished. So we cannot wait. We must lead the fight back and build structures that will allow us to better foresee these global threats.
The 2015 attacks shocked the world and damaged relations between communities. President Macron has since tried to dampen emotions, but France remains at a crossroads. Any further Islamophobic sentiments will only flame the tensions.
Trump and his fellow Republicans keep insisting that the US presidential election was rigged, calling for a recount of ballots in several key states. Trump and his team have filed several lawsuits contesting the outcome of the election. However, they have suffered legal setbacks in 3 battleground states, namely Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Arizona. Courts there rejected Republicans' call for probing the vote count process and blocking mail-in ballots. Meanwhile, U.S. prosecutors have asked Attorney General William Barr to rescind a memo that instructed them to publicly investigate allegations of vote counting irregularities. The prosecutors say they have not seen any unusual activity. Barr sent his memo after days of attacks on the integrity of the election by President Donald Trump and his Republican allies. Although Trump has refused to concede defeat, he said in recent remarks that time will tell which administration will take office in the White House in January.
Whatever happens in the future, who knows which administration it will be? I guess time will tell.
The remarks are the first indication that Trump could concede defeat in the disputed November 3rd presidential election. Still, some of Trump's supporters, as well as his fellow Republicans, are refusing to budge and remain hopeful that their candidate still has the chance to become the next president. The controversy over the election results comes against the backdrop of pro- and anti-Trump demonstrations. Trump supporters back his vote-rigging claims, while his opponents are happy with the projected victory of Joe Biden. Nevertheless, experts believe the nature of the U.S. regime will not change no matter who takes the reign at the White House.
What we're seeing is that the people who control both parties, the Democrats and Republicans, they want Trump out. You know, Trump is not perfect by any means. He's actually really bad for the American people. But the one thing that we can all give him credit is that he exposed the reality of the U.S. empire. He showed just how brutal it is. And I think for a lot of people on Wall Street and Washington who want to rebrand U.S. empire, Trump is too dangerous. And it's looking every day like Trump may be forced to concede.
Now, it remains to be seen who will be confirmed in office as the next U.S. president and whether or not there will be any major policy changes in the new administration.
On September 17, a resolution issued by the European Parliament urged EU member states to impose an arms embargo on Saudi Arabia over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi and the Yemen war. The resolution also contained an arms embargo on Cairo and Ankara, motivated by concerns Europeans' arms and military equipment might be used for internal repression in Egypt, and that Turkey's conduct in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea would run counter to the sovereignty of any EU member state. While some EU countries such as Germany, Finland and Denmark have adopted restrictions on the arms exports to Riyadh, Italy and other EU nations have ignored the resolution in full so far.
It's unacceptable that Egypt, a country known for human rights abuses, is the top importer of Italian weapons across the world. Saudi Arabia follows. We can't accept the countries involved in wars continue to receive our military equipment. Unfortunately, Italy hasn't done much since the EU Parliament adopted the resolution.
An Italian government report has found that the Unit for the Authorizations of Armament Materials green-lighted 57 times last year the supply of military systems, including bombs, torpedoes, rocket launchers and missiles, worth about 200 million euros to Saudi Arabia and UAE.
One in four arms sold worldwide in 2019 were produced in Europe, according to a report by CIPRI, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. France and Germany topped the list of European countries that trade in arms, while Italy came third.
We often look at the US as the main arms supplier worldwide. However, we forget that Europe also plays a major role. If the European Parliament only issues resolutions and not directives, all those countries not observing arms embargo cannot be sanctioned. Furthermore, there is a lack of political will among EU countries for change. European companies even compete with one another to sell more arms in conflicting countries.
Consecutive Italian governments have also ignored a domestic law passed in 1990 which bans the exports of weapons in countries in a state of war. Italy's arms exports stood at over 5 billion euros in 2019. Max Civili, Rome.
The United States presidential election continues to be unfinished and disputed. Democrat Joe Biden holds a slim lead, but President Donald Trump has significant public support from Republicans at the grassroots and elite levels to not concede. The election was preceded by months of controversy regarding the unprecedented use of mail-in ballots, which appeared to swing the election in the slight favor of Joe Biden at the last minute. A recent poll showed that a whopping 70% of Republicans do not believe the election was free and fair. Polls held just prior to the vote showed just half the number of Republican skeptics. Democrats say vote fraud has not yet been proven and that Trump must concede to prevent increasing distrust towards the nation's electoral process. But this is the third disputed election in the last six tries. Many are insisting that this election must be judicially vetted in order to prevent even more alienation, apathy, abstention, and anger. Others say the economic, social, and health disaster caused by the coronavirus makes this not the year to insist on transparency.
Six elections, that's my entire lifetime. So one in two of elections in my lifetime, and only I've been able to only vote in the last, I think, three of them. Or four of them. That says a lot about people's uncertainty of these elections, and that's just only going to grow if the system remains how it is.
The repeated electoral chaos is likely to undermine perpetual U.S. claims that their model of democracy is not only the best, but should be emulated around the world. Harvard ranked U.S. election integrity just 57th in the world, and that was last year.
This is not a model of a political system that would want to be mimicked. And it would only be mimicked if it's being used by the powerful. It would only be mimicked by them because they want something that undermines a majority view. And yeah, you should reject that entirely. If you really are for the small d democracy, if you're really for that, you would reject the American model of electing presidents.
The corporate-dominated U.S. mainstream media appears to have a united front that Biden won the election and that any legal challenges are frivolous. A significant percentage of over 70 million Trump voters don't appear to agree. Weeks of chaos and tensions appear certain as the Electoral College, the vote which actually decides the U.S. president, doesn't meet until December 14th. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said that indirect talks between Lebanon and Israel will continue over the maritime border demarcation, stressing that this does not mean it will lead to normalization. In a televised address to mark Lebanon's Martyr Day, Sayyid Nasrallah said the talks were instead meant to be technical and set limits so Lebanon can benefit from its natural resources.
Many have written that the maritime border negotiations would pave the way for normalization between Lebanon and Israel. This is empty talk. We will never be a part of any peace talks with Israel. We consider its existence to be cancerous and devilish, and this will never change.
Sayyid Nasrallah also commented on recent Israeli drills along the Lebanese borders, calling it a demonstration of strength the resistance has established. He said such exercises proved the Israeli army was in a difficult state, where it has shifted its activities from attacking to defending. Sayyid Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that Hezbollah has strong, lifelong powers that will help it overcome any Israeli maneuver against Lebanon and guarantee victory in the region. He also made similar remarks towards the U.S. administration. Commenting on the U.S. presidential elections, Sayyid Nasrallah said he was happy at President Donald Trump's, quote, humiliating downfall. However, he said America's foreign policy will stay in favor of Israel, despite a new administration. In regards to the recent U.S. sanctions against Lebanese officials, including Gibran Basil, Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. is seeking to cause political chaos in the country and remove the resistance force from the region. He stressed the plan was doomed to fail.
What gives a government like the American one, which commits all sorts of terrorism and corruption, the right to label our politicians as corrupt and sanction them? We need to act upon our sovereignty and stand up against those American policies.
Sayyid Nasrallah said the U.S. has failed its many attempts to pressure the resistance and turn the Lebanese people against Hezbollah through the war in Syria and the economic crisis in Lebanon.
These sanctions will do nothing. They will not affect internal relations or cause conflict in Lebanon. The U.S. has been trying for years to cause inner rivalry. It has tried to weaken the strongest component in Lebanon, which is the resistance. This U.S. failure is a victory for the resistance and the Lebanese people.
For his part, Sayyid Nasrallah praised Lebanese officials, including Minister Basil, for their courageous stance against the U.S. pressure, saying it was for the sake of the nation. Rana Alaeddin, Beirut.
Pakistan and Iran have moved forward to expand their bilateral cooperation in major fields. During Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif's visit to Islamabad, both neighbors decided to expand their ties in the field of commerce, investment, regional connectivity, security, and people-to-people exchanges. The border management and geostrategic issues in the region linked with the security of both countries were at the center of the bilateral discussions. Iran has a long-standing concern over the back-and-forth movement of militants and smugglers at its shared porous border with Pakistan, something which also came under bilateral discussions.
we had a very good discussion on border cooperation, including border markets, as well as opening a new cross, a new border crossing in Rimdan Gebit between Iran and Pakistan, which will happen hopefully within a week or two.
Pakistan and Iran also share concern over the political uncertainty revolving around Afghan peace deal after the disputed presidential elections in the United States amid allegations of electoral fraud. It remains unclear on whether or not Joe Biden will withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan by May next year under a peace deal between the current U.S. administration